Hello, and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. Maybe you could file today's program under the heading, The Love of Christ Changes Everything. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and our guest this hour was a childhood victim of priestly sexual abuse. But don't worry, this is not just a story of cruel injustice. Because of the gospel, it's been transformed into a very different kind of story, one that I feel confident you will be happy to hear today. What our guest does professionally might surprise you. He raises millions of dollars for the Catholic Diocese of Cincinnati and its parishes. Michael Vandenberg is the Director of Stewardship for the Diocese and a husband and father of four. His story was made very public in the pages of the Cincinnati Enquirer early this year, and we are as pleased as we can be to welcome Mr. Vandenberg to share his story with us today. Michael Vandenberg, thank you so much for being with us today on Catholic Answers Focus.
Thanks, Cy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, how long have you been raising money for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati?
Archdiocese, yeah. So for a bit over 10 years now.
And how do you end up being the guy who runs the stewardship office for the diocese?
Well, that's a really good question. I often think that this is the culmination of a path that God has planned for me. And I just said yes at all the times that it was important to say yes. And, you know, I had spent about 8 years before I came to the Archdiocese in secular fundraising for a college, for a hospital, for the American Cancer Society. And when I learned about this new opportunity, it was actually a newly created position and a newly created department. It gave me an opportunity to expand my view of fund development to be very much a part of my Christian experience. So I really jumped at that opportunity when it arose, and thankfully I was the successful applicant, and it's just been an absolute blessing every day for 10 years.
Well, when you talk about your Christian experience, that begins at birth. You were a cradle Catholic, correct?
That's right. Yeah. I was born to parents who, one of whom was then an agnostic and eventually became an atheist, and the other who was very devout and stuck with her faith through thick and thin. So my mother, who coincidentally is named Mary, was really my proto-disciple and still is to this day. Just a wonderful example of faith that I can trace my own faith to.
Were you an altar boy? Did you have that kind of upbringing? Like, did you Catholic school, or you knew priests or didn't know priests? Or how was that in your earliest years?
Well, I was the youngest of nine children, and my older brothers and sisters had the experience of Catholic schools, but at some point my father decided that wasn't a good path for us. And so that, you know, by the time I came along, that was not our experience. But he, being an agnostic, he was still very respectful of the traditions that his wife, my mother, had for the household. So we prayed together at meals, and we had family meals together, all 11 of us. And even as my older brothers and sisters left the house, we continued having the sort of routine that one would witness in many Catholic households for years. I was not I was not ever an altar server per se, but we also had, although we were regular attendees at church, we kind of had several different venues that we visited over the years, and so there weren't any super long standing relationships that we had at one particular parish for any great length of time.
The priest then who at whose hands you suffered abuse, was this someone known to you and your family, or how what was the connection?
Yes.
There? It was.
Yes, he was.
And this happened at the age of 13.
Well, it's really more in the 11 to 12 time frame.
And so I assume then that changed your relationship with the church in your adolescent years.
Well, it's interesting because as I look back, I don't think that it changed my relationship with the church so much. Because at the time, I didn't really realize how important and how negative those experiences were.
I see.
And it was really only the perspective of a mature adult that I think that's pretty common among people who experience any sort of sexual abuse, whether it's at the hands of clergy or non-clergy. Many times it takes the perspective of being older to really piece together the effect that it had. To put it another way, I don't know that I was any less devout or less religious because of that experience compared to my peers. I wouldn't say that I ever left the church. I certainly never did that. But the church wasn't really an important part of my life for many years until the death of my brother, which happened when I was 19. And that was really a watershed experience for me. And at that point, the offending priest was still in my life. And so that sort of reawakened those negative experiences, but also brought me closer to God, because as happens with many people who suffer tragedy in their lives, it provides a decision point to make choices that either bring you closer to God or push you farther away from God. And gratefully, I began making choices that brought me closer to God.
This is one of the things that comes out in the Cincinnati Inquirer story, is your sense that it's small choices, kind of almost mundane, sometimes seemingly insignificant choices day to day, that set the ultimate course. Is that was your experience at that point in your life?
Well, it was, and I'm not a particularly learned person. I'm not a theologian. I don't even consider myself an apologist. I do feel that I'm called to witness, and what I experienced was latching on to very simple things like pray always in all things at all times, and the concept of seeing Christ in the eyes of others. The idea that every minute of every day could be used in some way to ponder what God's calling me to do, either in that instance or in a broader sense of how the overall trajectory of my life is going. And so the smaller choices, seeking out kindness and seeing the goodness in others and really following the example of simple charity, that's something that was very appealing to me and something that I knew was sustaining to me in my rough childhood development years. And I think it bears noting that, most people who become engaged in inappropriate relationships as children, they are most often in life situations that are just overall not healthy in other parts of their lives, which makes them easy targets for adults who engage in inappropriate behavior with them. And so it's important to remember that that in the vast majority of cases that I'm aware of anyway, and I'm no expert, but I've certainly spent a lot of time over my life ruminating on this and talking about it to a lot of people. There's so much more going on in these young people's lives than just their relationship with their perpetrator. And again, this is not something unique to inappropriate clergy relationships.
Yeah.
This is a societal problem. It's not particular to the church.
But as you say, it takes time, even in your own development, to come to a point of realizing that these things were maybe not normal, or that they were harmful, or even to get to the point of saying that they've left wounds in me, they've left hurts in me. So would you say that all that time of really choosing for Christ, little by little, bit by bit, following what, as you said, a very simple path, but the path of the gospel, little by little, would you say that as an adult, when you began to reflect on these experiences and process them in a mature brain, that you already had a relationship with Christ that could help you do that?
I think that's definitely true. I think that I also subscribe to the belief that faith itself is a gift, and not everybody has that gift. I've known many people in my life, my father probably chief among them, who could not develop a faith life. It just wasn't a gift that they had. Now, interestingly, my father's family, they were missionaries in China. And so there's a tradition in his family of being very faithful and sort of living out your faith as a Christian and doing for others and caring for others and that sort of thing. But at some point in his life, he began making choices that pushed him farther away from his faith life. And then, as I mentioned earlier, he went from this long period of an agnostic feeling of, you know, not knowing whether there is a God or not, to a more atheistic feeling, and then more of a militant atheism, where he was seeking others out to validate his view that, you know, there is no God, and everyone who thinks there is, you know, is a fool. Well, I knew that that drew me in to his life in a much different way. That helped me recognize that, wow, I have this faith that won't ever go away, or it's never gone away from me. This is one thing I've always had.
Yep.
And I don't know if he ever had it or not, but if he did, he lost it. And so that reminded me that, you know, faith itself is truly a gift. And, you know, I can sit with him, I can accompany him, I can love him. You know, I held his hand as he was dying, but I wasn't praying with him. I was praying to myself, but I didn't need to drag him along with me in a context that he didn't understand or appreciate. And I have to say, Si, that was really another blessing to me, to be able to accompany someone who's that close to me, who does not share my sense in any stretch of the word of faith. And again, that illustrated to me that, wow, all through this, from the time that I had any idea that there was a God who loved me, I always believed in Jesus, and I always believed in his saving grace for me. I always believed that he was willing to accompany me into the depths of whatever I was dealing with, and that he would be at the end no matter what. And not only did I believe that the whole way, but it's clear to me that not everybody does, and not everybody can. And how does that affect my own outlook on how I accompany others in all of their situations, whether they profess to be faithful people or not? Am I willing to accompany them? And that's been something that has driven me in my interactions with people from that point onward. I spent a good number of years in law enforcement as a police officer. I've seen people at their worst, and, you know, sometimes at their best, but most often at their worst. You know, what was I willing to accompany them? Was I willing to witness to them in a way that they could understand, that in my mind showed God's love for them, but maybe in a way that they didn't quite understand what that was? And am I willing to accompany them for any length of time, to show an interest in them, to witness in terms that they can appreciate that, even if they don't believe in a God that cares for them, how can I be as much as I can be love for them? And of course, we know God is love. So that's really been a driving force for me throughout all of my adulthood.
That word accompaniment is very important in your understanding of your own vocation as a Christian person, as a Catholic man.
Well, it's something that until Pope Francis reminded all of us how important accompaniment is, I don't know that I would have articulated it that way. I would have maybe articulated it as spending time with people and showing concern for them and showing empathy. But I think it's been a tremendous gift from Pope Francis. It's not that he invented accompaniment, but he reminds us that how powerful it is to physically be with others, and to do that doesn't mean that you're validating their beliefs. It doesn't mean that you're somehow selling out if they're living in a way that you don't approve of, or that your faith doesn't approve of, or that society doesn't approve of. But it shows God's love. It shows God that we are serious when we say, when he says to us, go and make disciples, and we're responding to that as disciples of Christ. But what is it we're really doing? Do we hole up in our little Catholic ghettos, or do we go out and encounter people and accompany them?
I appreciate that you give credit to Pope Francis, because it's been extraordinary the way he has made that language part of our common language as Catholics. But there's a priest that you yourself accompanied, Father Frank Masarella, and this was before Pope Francis. And I wonder if you could tell the story of your relationship with Father Frank. An extraordinary story, I will say, before you begin to tell that story, because Father Frank Masarella was himself a perpetrator of sexual abuse on young people. And late in his life, you came into his life. And could you tell us a little bit about that relationship?
Sure. So Frank was a supporter of our annual appeal that I'm responsible for. And so he ended up on an invitation list for an event. And I wasn't mindful of the fact that there might be somebody on the invitation list who shouldn't be invited to an event. And namely in his situation, because he was commended to a life of prayer and penance for inappropriate behavior with young girls in the 1950s. So Frank was a priest in his 90s. He has since passed away a few years ago now. And basically I was put in the position of having to uninvite him to this event that I had just invited him to.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, the reason I knew that I had to uninvite him was he himself called up and said, "Are you sure that you want me to come to this?"
Oh, really? He outed himself to you?
Absolutely. And, uh-huh. and so that was interesting from the get-go, that obviously, and from there on out, from the time that I met him, I recognized pretty quickly that this was a guy who was very serious about doing what he's supposed to do and not violating anything about that. And, you know, he commented to me on several occasions, I want to be the priest that God, I want to be the best priest that God wants me to be. And, you know, he was committed to a life of prayer and penance. And every time I would, because I ended up calling on him regularly after the first time where I had to break it to him that he couldn't come to this event. Every time I would come to his door, I could see him sitting praying his breviary or wrapping up mass that he was allowed to celebrate by himself. He took his canonical sentence very seriously, and he had a prayer list longer than any I've ever seen. He was constantly celebrating mass for different people who had asked for that. Again, privately, because he wasn't allowed to present himself as a priest. And I have to say, his witness to me of priestly humility, given his circumstances, was really moving. And
So you are a survivor of sexual abuse from a priest, and now you're telling me you were impressed by this priest who was himself a perpetrator of sexual abuse on young girls because he had embraced his penance.
That's right. And I know this sounds very, very strange to express, but you know, I don't want to gloss over any of the horrible evils that he committed, that he admitted to committing. I certainly don't want to gloss over that. There's certainly many people who were harmed, not just the girls that he admitted to fondling, but also their families and you know, all the whole circle of hurt that comes from any sort of abuse like that. And it was horrific, and it, you know, it never should have happened, and he certainly is to blame for that. No one else is to blame. He's responsible for that. And there's also this inherent dignity that he did his best to display where he was doing whatever he could to make reparations for what had then been, you know, act 60 years in the past. I believe he was just a few days short of his 99th birthday when he passed away.
So why
and
did
I,
you
I think I met him.
Why did you keep going to visit him?
Well, what struck me when I met him was, first of all, he made it as easy as possible on me. He knew why I was coming, that tell him he couldn't come to this. And he made it as easy as possible for me to sort of embarrassingly say, "Sorry, I invited you, but I have to uninvite you." So that was number one. Number two, I did have a genuine curiosity to learn more about a priest who would abuse children without having to confront my own abuser. I certainly had that motivation, that I wanted to learn more about what was going on in his brain.
So you didn't tell Father Frank that you were a victim of abuse?
I did not. And that's kind of an interesting point, is that in all of my conversations with him, I would visit with him about monthly from there on out. In all my conversations with him, I had the strong sense that he was very forthright with me. But ironically, I was not forthright with him, because I didn't tell him of this motivation that I had to learn more about, you know, how a priest could act like this. So, and I also developed a greater appreciation for what many therapists and psychiatrists would term arrested development, where there's a particular area, particularly in developing, and a developing adolescent and their psychosexual development, that just doesn't develop like everybody else. Because when we would get on this subject and I would ask him very specific questions, it was like I was no longer talking to a mature 97-year-old person, but I was instead talking to an 11-year-old.
Really?
And it was, and again, I'm not a therapist. I don't claim to know anything in particular about how any of this works. All I can do is tell you what I witnessed, which was that it was clear to me that he did not have the capacity to understand fully how harmful his actions were, and to really grasp the depth of how wrong all of that behavior was.
You're saying he accepted his penance, he accepted the sentence of the church, but you don't think he had the psychological capacity to know the harm he had done. He accepted it because he wanted to be a good priest and obedient, but not because he said, because he had a horror at what he had done himself.
Yeah, I just, at a certain level, he knew that it was wrong, but as far as appreciating how wrong it was, I don't know that he had the capacity to do that. It really helped me to understand that, number one, anyone who has this sort of problem, to the extent that it can be discovered in advance, should not be in a position of trust and authority as a member of the clergy would be, or any
right
leader in a faith context or a school context or anything to do with children. I mean, that's clear. And to be sure, it took decades for those engaged in this field of treating people with these disorders, took decades to figure out that this is not anything you can cure somebody of. This is, yeah, they're always going to be with this. And, you know, you can put fences around them and you can keep them away from trouble by keeping them away from kids. But you can't change their desires and their, and it's foolish to think that you can change their behavior if you keep them around children. So I definitely came away from our interactions with a very strong validation of our current stance, not just in the church, but growing in society in general, that people with these sort of attractions just cannot be around children. And interestingly, I've also, before I came to work for the church formally, I volunteered as a member of our Child Protection Review Board, and that's a capacity that I've continued serving on for the last 11 years. I think I was as a parent of small children, I was very pleased to learn about all of the measures that we had begun taking very seriously to protect children, and we continue to take very seriously to protect children. And furthermore, I was surprised at first, but then not so surprised that in our public institutions, like public schools that my children attended, we didn't have the same protections in place.
Yeah.
And, you know, years ago, everybody thought this was a church problem. And not only did they think it was a church problem, they thought it was a Catholic church problem.
Would you say it's an endemic problem, that it's everywhere?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what we've learned. And so what happened is that, you know, shortly after I joined the Child Protection Review Board in 2006, I became aware of public school folks contacting us, asking us for advice on how to protect kids. You know, but the irony is that, you know, the popular belief at the time was that, you know, the Catholics, they're the ones who don't know how to protect kids. So, and to this day, I mean, I don't know what it's like for you, but for me, whenever I'm listening to the news, it's hard to go a week without hearing about a coach or a teacher or someone else as an authority figure with children having this problem. And it's pretty unusual that we hear about clergy having this problem anymore. It's not that it's ever going to go away, and we certainly can't be complacent about it. We have to stay vigilant. But I think people are starting to slowly realize that, again, this is a societal issue at large. It's not just a church issue.
What would you say this relationship then between you and Father Frank? What has it given you a different sense of what it is to love in a gospel way, or what it means that God loves us? And is that a kind of lesson that you can share with us, like transmit to other people? What do you come away with it from it with?
Well, every person has an inherent dignity, and we have to remember that every person is made in an image and likeness of God. Their choices obscure that image for us. And it's usually small choices that lead to larger choices that make us judge them as being unworthy of our attention, unworthy of our love. And I think when we take the time to realize that there is this inherent dignity, it helps us be Christian. It helps us to accompany. It helps us to spread the gospel. It helps us to go and make disciples and teaching them all that God has taught us. We have to begin with accompaniment. And there is no human that does not have the dignity for that.
I can imagine, Michael, that there are probably fellow victims of priestly sexual abuse of yours who may say, come on, I mean, you want to give dignity to this person who ruined other people's lives, that a sense of outrage is appropriate. And maybe there's a sense, they may have a sense of betrayal from you to say a thing like that. Do you ever get that kind of pushback from other victims of priestly sexual abuse?
I do. And I would say two things about that. Number one, there is no stereotypical victim, and there's no cookie cutter response to being victimized. Every person has his or her own path to walk when it comes to how they respond to what's happened to them and the awful things that's happened to them. So that's number one. I try not to ever judge anyone else's choices. Number two, many times people who continually express outrage, what they're telling me is that they're stuck in the anger phase of managing their grief. And that's what we do. We again, I'm not a therapist, but this is what I've learned about what happens to people who have been victimized. You go through grief, just like you go through cycles of grief when you're dealing with an impending death or loss of a loved one or loss of your own health. There's denial. There's all these responses that are part of this normal reaction to grief over a very negative life event. And it's also possible to get stuck in one of those phases of grief. And anger is one that is easy to get stuck in. And you know, I can't fault anybody for that. And I cannot possibly overstate the fact that none of this abhorrent, awful, evil behavior is acceptable. It's not. It's not acceptable to me. It shouldn't be acceptable to anybody. No one is explaining away that, oh, well, this person's not responsible for this. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about we have appropriate reaction. When we witness evil acts, when we hold people responsible for their evil acts, we have appropriate reactions to that, right? We have our justice system. We have our compensation to victims. We have rehabilitation to the extent that we can rehabilitate offenders. And, of course, now we know this particular type of offender is not someone who can be rehabilitated to the point where this attraction to teens or to prepubescents will ever go away. And so we have to put fences around that. Well, how do we do that? Well, we have all sorts of mechanisms in place. But my point is that of all those appropriate things to do in reaction to those evil acts and to realize the danger that an individual presents to others in the future, through all of that, we must remember they do not lose the dignity of a human person. And that's a very hard concept for many people to grasp.
Very, very hard. Very hard indeed. That's a struggle, I think, isn't it? That is part of the struggle of the Christian faith, is to have faith that the humanity of another person is not ever so defaced that you can just dismiss them.
Exactly. And I think that we don't have to look very far. If we think critically about this, we don't have to look very far to see how far we've come in how we treat prisoners, for example. I mean, it wasn't too many years ago that if you went to prison for stealing a sandwich, you know, depending on where you are, and actually some places in the world today it's still the case, you could lose an arm or a hand, or, you know, you could be subjected to the most cruel living conditions. And we've come so far with how we treat people who commit various degrees of evil that harm others. But this is one area that many people have an especially hard time dealing with. In fact, in prison, people who have offended against children have to be kept from everybody else because other people in the prison want to kill them because of their acts against children. So this is a particularly difficult aspect of justice and reparation that we continue to face. I think there are still many people who would love to, lock them up and throw away the key and don't give a whole lot of thought to the dignity of people who could commit these types of acts. But for me, I have to say, Cy, that I've learned that my glimpse of the love that God has for me is in pretty much direct proportion to my experience of sorrow and suffering, in that it really did not become possible for me to understand his love without having suffered as I have, not just in this particular way, but in as I look back in my life and always. To put it another way, when I look at a mother holding an infant and someone says to me, "Oh, look, you know, the baby loves her mommy. She's just so happy and so content in her mother's arms." My first thought is, no, she doesn't. That baby's comfortable. That baby doesn't know anything about love. That baby's feeling good right now. You know who knows something about love? That mother knows something about love. You know, she was pregnant with that baby for 9 months, and she gave birth to that baby, and she's worried about that baby ever since she knew she was pregnant. She has suffered, and she understands love. She knows love of her baby in a way that her baby can't know, because her baby doesn't know. Now, when that baby grows up, that baby gets a greater understanding in bits and pieces of what love is. And for those of us who have had teenagers, sometimes we think they don't understand too much about that until much later in life. But I that's what I think of when I think of God revealing his love to me. He's revealed it to me in my relationship with my wife. He's really revealed it to me in my relationship with my kids through the thick and thin. But it's been the sorrows, it's been the suffering that really helps me see that he's right there with me, and he loves me as much and more. And every time I can conceive of greater suffering for myself, I have the aspiration of knowing his love that much more along with it. And that's something that I learned first from practice. But I also learned later, much later in life, that St. Catherine of Siena had a few things to say about that. And that's been a really inspirational source for me.
Michael, we're going to have to leave it there. And I think that's just an excellent place to leave it. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk with you again. For the listener, Michael Vanderberg, his story is in the Cincinnati Inquirer. If you just search his name and put the word Cincinnati next to it, you'll find it. The headline on the article, which is by Dan Horn, is "Abused by a Priest, Now a Champion of the Church: Michael Vanderberg's Journey of Faith." Michael Vanderberg, thank you so much for sharing your extraordinary story with us.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. God bless you.
And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us again on Catholic Answers Focus. We appreciate that you join us each week for this, and we'll see you again next week for another episode of Catholic Answers Focus.